This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that separate but equal public schools for black students and white students were unconstitutional. The ruling paved the way for integrating America's public schools, and it was a major victory for the civil rights movement. Yet more than 60 years after the Brown v. Board of Education desegregation decision, many schools are still racially divided. According to 2012-2013 state data, in almost half of schools in Ohio and Kentucky, 90% or more students are the same race, usually white. And in a report done by EdBuild, Fault Lines, America's most segregating school district borders, schools in Ohio are rated number one for economic segregation. And here to talk about the history of school segregation and the segregation that exists in schools today are Executive Vice President and Provost of the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, Dr. Michael Battle, and Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Malik Matthew. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Michael and Malik, thank you for being here this afternoon.
It's a pleasure.
Michael, talk about prior to the Brown v. Board of Education ruling, before that came across, what was segregation like in America's school system? What was the level of segregation that we were seeing?
Prior to the Brown versus Board of Education ruling, there was the assumption based on Plessy versus Ferguson that there was some kind of legitimacy to the notion of separate but equal. The fallacy in the reasoning is that there was never equality, even though there was tremendous separation.
I think that's what the Brown case was
Absolutely.
Saying.
And so the Brown case was a ruling that said that the notion of separate but equal was inherently unconstitutional. Inherently unconstitutional in part because it never arrived at any sense of equality and because it created an imbalance in the separation of kids who were going to school. So Brown versus Board of Education was an effort to turn back the Plessy versus Ferguson decision. The problem is that immediately after Brown versus Board of Education, there were efforts to undermine the civil rights gain. There were efforts to undermine the notion of integration, the notion of bringing people together.
Yeah, there was a lot of struggle and resistance.
A lot of struggle and resistance. And that struggle and resistance then was given a sense of boost when Congress allowed for a movement away from the forced desegregation modalities, and then many schools simply reverted back to the segregationist modalities that they had always had prior to Brown versus Board of Education.
So was there ever a point where Brown started to have an impact, though, where we started to see some improvement?
Right, there were tremendous improvements. I was 4 years old in 1954. So I ended up having the benefit of going to some integrated schools and watching the efforts of busing. And then when my children were in school, I was very active in the local NAACP, and I was one of the ones who sort of encouraged the integration of schools in Hampton, Virginia, where I was teaching at Hampton University at the time. And we introduced a form of busing where busing was not only black kids going to white schools, but white kids being bused into black schools, into communities. That worked exceedingly well, again, until there was this relaxation on the part of Congress out of the false belief that we had achieved the goals of integration, and then people simply reverted back to a modality of by choice segregation and by choice separation. Integration is a wonderful aim. But it has to be more than racial integration. It has to be class cross-sector integration, where people are integrated not only on race but on economic background and economic class. And the only way you could actually achieve that is that the job market has to be integrated. Then the neighborhoods would be integrated because the job markets would be integrated. But if you have segregation and racism in job markets and in neighborhood patterns, you will never have integrated school systems based on a neighborhood school modality.
So you agree with the recent research then that says that segregation is still a problem?
Oh, absolutely.
In school systems these
absolutely.
Days.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The country's not living up to Brown v. Board of Education. Malik, what are your thoughts?
First of all, I want to just I've heard these terms used interchangeably, integration and desegregation. I actually don't think they're interchangeable terms. Desegregation is accomplished by simply having a school that is entirely of one particular demographic and inserting a few here or there. I wouldn't call that school a fully integrated school. An integrated school, to me, signals that there is a critical mass of representation for multiple groups and that they're all part of that community. As opposed to just having the few students who are kind of treated as guests in that community. They are outsiders. They are very much the visitors who are in some cases welcome or some cases not welcome. So I think the differentiation between those two terms is meaningful. Also, you know, as he was mentioning, we're talking about school inequality in a system that no longer needs to speak its name with regard to race. So they're saying, well, this is not a racist segregation situation. This is just a matter of community schools letting the chips fall where they may. Of course, we know that communities themselves are segregated, and that the idea of moving people around from one place to another will always receive political pushback. And one of the things that I tell my students all the time is that success and shortcoming are both temporary states. So whenever you make any progress, progress to some always feels like regression to others. And so that pushback will yield what we're seeing now, not necessarily because people are intentionally discriminating. You know, it's not that the parents themselves are necessarily in opposition to integration. Some may consciously be. But for many others, it's just status quo. They're just following through with business as usual. And as long as the system permits it, that's really what's going to go on because people are making rational choice decisions that they think are in the best interest of their children.
And how much of this is economic, Malik, more than it is racial?
Well, so last time we were here, we spoke about the – because we keep meeting like this.
We do. We talked about institutional oppression yeah. and yes.
So when we talk about race and socioeconomic status, these are in fact separate factors, but they're not independent of each other. There is certainly overlap. So that socioeconomic inequality has a very strong racialized element, and not unintentionally so. Historically, that's been, you know, the order of the day is that you create inequality by way of subordinating in many different axes, including job market and education and all these other areas. So when we see inequality along socioeconomic lines, it's likely to yield in a city that has racial diversity, racial disparities as well, and racial segregation as well, because socioeconomically we're divided that way. What it does offer is plausible deniability. Because people have this sense that social class is something.
So you say it's not a race issue. It's an economics issue.
Because social class, there's this illusion. It's part of the American Dream narrative that social class is something that we individually control and that we can gain or lose status entirely based upon our own whims. And so if you can make that argument that it's a class distinction rather than a race distinction, then it seems like the clustering is somewhat earned as opposed to imposed.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Megan in Glendale. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two quick comments and or questions that I'd like to hear the gentleman discuss. The first is, it's my understanding, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, but I thought that Ohio has at least twice held, the Ohio Supreme Court has at least twice held that our real estate tax method of funding our school systems was unconstitutional.
Not sure how many times.
Yet that still hasn't changed.
Yeah, it was the DeRolf decision was the – how many times, Malik?
I think it's at least four.
Oh, four times.
Okay, thank you.
But I know there was
– And that perpetuates the economic disparity, clearly.
And that's not unique to Ohio, unfortunately. There are a number of school systems where the tax base determines the funding of the schools, which automatically renders disparity and inequality based upon the capacity of certain neighborhoods to afford a higher tax rate than other neighborhoods are able to afford.
Wow. Is there any way to enforce our Supreme Court decisions?
Well, there are always legal ways to enforce Supreme Court decisions. What happens, just as in the Voters' Rights Act, you find that people will sometime make a determination that the intent of the Supreme Court decision had been accomplished. And when they think that the intent has been accomplished, then there is a regression. People thought that the intent of Brown versus Board of Education was simply to integrate school systems or to break down walls of segregation. The intent was actually to improve the educational capacity and opportunities of each and every student. That intent has never been accomplished, and we will be working on fulfilling that intent for a long, long period of time. Malik made a very brilliant point earlier when he talked about how many decisions that are made by parents in terms of choice are not reflective of any individual desire to be separated from other people. What happens is that there is a system-oriented way of isolating and separating people that then frees us from the individual responsibility from choice, because the system is so arranged that kids are separated. The systems of taxation, the system of who can buy a house where, the systems that arrange how people are managing up with mobility in terms of the job market. These are systemic issues that are much larger than the individualized issues, which then also frees us from the responsibility associated with decision making.
And if I'm not correct, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the Ohio Supreme Court decision, didn't they more or less say, legislature, it's up to you to come up with the appropriate
system?
Well,
it's always legislature, right? So legislators need to put these laws into effect. Now the court can come back and say, hey, we told you. But it's like, you know, telling your kids to go to bed unless you pick them up and physically toss them in the bed.
Exactly.
You know, you're just going to keep going with, you know, every type of excuse. And legislators respond to voter pressures. And many voters are going to be in opposition to this, especially in politically empowered communities. And you have to bear in mind that, again, what a lot of this turns on is the assumption that it's a meritocratic system. So as long as there's the assumption that statuses can be earned or not earned, then it's hard to politically move the landscape to get some of these changes imposed. I mean, we talk about schools being good schools and bad schools, and we recognize that school inequality matters and it affects the outcomes for children. But I think it's unique to think about how we've kind of reframed the meritocratic argument. It goes from the child has done these things to earn these opportunities to I as a parent have done these things, and therefore I, through my work, have earned the right for my children to get better than somebody else's.
And we need to take a quick break. And Megan, did you get all your questions in, by the way?
That was great. I have one other question that I'd like to ask, but I'll be glad to wait.
Okay, can you hang on till we get this break in, and then we'll come right back to you. All right.
Thank you very much.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, here to talk about the segregation that exists in schools today. Executive Vice President and Provost of the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, Dr. Michael Battle, and Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Malik Matthew. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Megan, go ahead. What was the other question you had?
Thank you. Yes, Dr. Matthews mentioned the difference between desegregation and integration, and I think this might play into that a bit. But my question is, I listened to a female theologian the other week who is also an activist, and it was her opinion that to some extent we needed to work around some reconciliation for our African-American youth. Since Brown versus Board of Education, we've sent some of our children into places that are not necessarily safe and where they were not necessarily worshipped and cared for in the same way that other children are. And I'd just like to hear these gentlemen and Dr. Matthew, especially, your comments or thoughts on that.
Well, when we move people into these different locations, the hope is that eventually they will integrate. You know, so we desegregate and then we hope for integration, and we move past integration to inclusion and eventually empowerment. But that doesn't always play out that way, you know, because physical space can be occupied by force, but really we're talking about political processes, we're talking about social dynamics that give rise to inequalities. So what we've seen sometimes is that we may move people from one location to another location where the overall performance of the second school may be better, but it doesn't necessarily serve that particular individual child the same way. So when we are aiming to expand access, and I think that's a goal that is a worthy goal, we should also think about how we can expand understanding, cultural sensitivity, more than just sensitivity, because it's more than just hurting feelings, cultural awareness and understanding that can really allow the environment to benefit from an influx of new students and the students to benefit from the environment itself, as opposed to just aiming for optics.
Yeah, I agree fully that the aim should be to try to reach a point where people can learn to not only cooperate and get along with each other, but to desire to be in the presence of each other. Integration has a benefit beyond associating one group of persons with another group of persons. The benefit is teaching people that we live in a very diverse culture and a very diverse world, and that our own survival as a nation and as a people will depend on our capacity to work cooperatively one with the other. One of the problems in the early efforts to desegregate schools was you sent poor kids into prosperous neighborhoods for 6 hours a day, and then they went back to neighborhoods where the houses didn't look the same. There were no two parents in the household. There were no two cars in the driveway. The father or mother did not have the kind of job that allowed the kid then to engage in the after-school activities that the more privileged child engaged in because their family was a family of greater affluence. The effort, I have always said, is that we have to reach a point where as a society we determine that we are one united nation, united people, United States of America, and it is in all of our best interest that every person born in this country has equal opportunity to succeed, to get a good job, to live in a great neighborhood, and to do all of the wonderful things that anybody else has. But as long as poverty and race are dancing so much on the same street, like Dr. Malik said, Dr. Matthew said, they are different components of a similar problem, but they dance on the same street too often, where poverty and race dance on the same street. We need to make sure that there's nothing automatic or there's nothing overly familiar with race and poverty. If we could break through that syndrome, we will discover that we would have arrived at what Martin King called a beloved community. We are a long way away from that. And I think it's shameful that we're so far away.
Well, if I could just jump in real quick. The decoupling of race and socioeconomic status is critical, but I also don't think that I want to caution that we also need to pay attention to socioeconomic inequality in and of itself, absent race, because especially in the state of Ohio, we can see a lot of rural poverty. A lot of white poverty is concentrated in rural areas where ideas like school choice won't work as well. In an inner city area, you can bus kids across town and maybe they get there in 15 minutes longer than they would otherwise to get to school. But in rural areas, you're bringing them an hour from town to town. You know, so we really have to think holistically about many different types of inequality.
That's true. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because a lot of times when we talk about poverty, we ignore white poverty. And people act as if poverty is a black and Latino issue. There are more poor white people in the U.S. in terms of raw numbers, not percentages, than there are poor black and Latino people in the U.S. So poverty is not a black-Latino issue. It's an issue that we must all face. And if we could recognize that there's a greater similarity between a poor, struggling white person in the rural areas trying to make it in our society and an African-American and a Latino in the cities trying to make it in our society. And if we could ever break through the artificiality of the barriers of race and see the commonality of struggle and the effort to progress, you would have a united front that nobody could stand against. Poor white folk, African-Americans are struggling, Latinos are going to struggle. Nobody could stand against that kind of combination.
Michael and Malik, thank you so much for being here this afternoon. Executive Vice President and Provost of the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, Dr. Michael Battle, and Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Malik Matthew. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Immigration and the refugee crisis are affecting millions of people worldwide and reshaping much of today's global political landscape. A group of Xavier University faculty and staff, dubbed the Mission Animators, are providing an extensive year-long program to examine immigration, migration, and refugees. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll learn about Xavier's Mission Animators, and we'll hear about working to create the new Uptown Innovation District. That's on Cincinnati Edition, tomorrow afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.